Hey there, you're listening to What the Riff? Join us as we remember the great rock and roll hits from a month between 1965 and 1995. We're going to riff on all things about the bands, the members, and the goings-on during that time. We hope to inspire you to find and download the songs you hear today, whether you're fans who forgot about some of these tracks or maybe never even heard them before. Check out our blog at whattheriff.com or follow us on Facebook at What the Riff. Here's a shout out to our sponsors, Right Column Financial, offering CFO and bookkeeping services for small business, Stanton Electric, a commercial electrical specialist, and Marbury Creative Group, a brand development agency that helps companies tell it better. So let's turn up the volume and enjoy this episode of What the Riff?
Republican candidate Ronald Reagan is elected president of the United States, defeating incumbent President Jimmy Carter by a landslide. Iraqi President Saddam Hussein declares a holy war against Iran, and 4,800 die in the series of earthquakes that devastate southern Italy. This is November 1980, and you're listening to What the Riff. I'm Wayne.
I'm Rob.
I'm Brian.
And I'm Bruce.
And Rob brings us this classic album.
Yes, indeed. Listen to that voice. One of my favorite groups and one of rock's best-known trios, among a few that we've covered, ZZ Top, Rush, Nirvana, Cream. There's a few more out there.
Triumph.
These guys were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on March 10th, 2003. You're listening to The Police from their November 1980 album, Zenyatta Mandata.
This is in my opinion, this is a voice. You don't have to ask any questions. You know exactly who you're listening to.
Oh, yeah. It's very distinctive, isn't it?
Very distinct. And that is Gordon Sumner, otherwise known as Sting.
The wrestler?
Bass and lead singer. And you've got Stuart Copeland on drums. He was an American. And then you've got Andy Summers on guitar. This album is Zenyatta Mandata. It's their third of five albums. I didn't actually realize they'd only put out five albums.
And they're great albums. All five of them are just terrific. Obviously, the last one was the pinnacle of
Synchronicity.
I'm missing one then. I thought this was their second.
Outlandish, D'Amore, Regatta de Blanc, Zenyatta Mandata, that's Ghost of the Machine, and Synchronicity.
That's it. That's what
I'm it's kind of difficult, though, guys, if you think about it, to actually do an album if you're fighting the whole time.
Oh, yeah. We'll hear a little bit about that.
Now, creative
sure.
tension. Yes. That's what they had right there.
That's a nice way of putting it.
That was the biggest issue. This song is da-do-do-do, da-da-da-da.
That can be found in a lot of children's bookstores.
Yes. It was written by Sting because he was kind of making a comment on how people just love simple-sounding songs. He's like, we could just do this and make it a song.
And guess
what?
And it became a hit. It's a hit.
It was the first single off the album. It came out in November of 1980. And I don't know if you heard, you know, some of the lyrics are good. Like he says, poets, priests, and politicians have words to thank for their positions. When their eloquence escapes you, their logic ties you up and rapes you. So it's just like, I mean, it gets pretty intense.
Yeah.
Not just a children's song, even though it's using children's words.
Well, the children won't be able to understand those lyrics.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. But what a song. And this is probably one of the most well-known off the album here.
I like the offbeat.
Yeah. Copeland's just awesome.
He is a fantastic drummer, and I think he's kind of underrated when you're thinking about drummers.
Yes.
But you listen to this stuff. I mean, and this is one of these things, when you've got this power trio, every person has to be, you know, really adept at their instrument.
They got to be on their game.
Yeah, and they all are fantastic.
This band was started by Stuart Copeland. He started it after meeting Sting. In 1976, he was in a band called Curved Air, and he met Sting, who was a teacher by day, and at night he was playing with this jazz rock fusion band called Last Exit.
And okay, so I can see that.
They kind of bumped into each other in the music scene, and then Sting ended up moving to London in 1977. He looked up Copeland, and they kind of started jamming together. It turned into a big, long jam session. They said, we've got chemistry, at least musically they did.
I felt it.
Yeah.
But, so that's a good one. This one here, this next track here, it's a deeper cut.
But I remember my neighbor, Mark Alley, he had a pool, and he put his speaker in the window, and he'd play this album, and we'd just be out at the pool hanging out with friend David Owen and Steve Owen and Todd Owen. Just, this is such a fun little song.
I don't know. To me, it's not a deeper cut because I do remember this song.
Yeah.
It's like I want to say it was on classic radio a lot, or it was
on rock radio, but it wasn't. It didn't hit the pop charts at all.
Listen to this verse here. It's so funny. He says, "You say you want to spend the winter in Firenze. You're so afraid to catch a dose of influenza. You live your life like a canary in a coal mine. You get so dizzy even walking in a straight line."
Oh.
That sounds
some solid lyrics right there.
That sounds like today to me. That sounds like.
There's a lot of people that are doing that, just staying at home because they're afraid they're going to get COVID.
Exactly. You're familiar with the term canary in a coal mine.
Yeah.
So the miners would take a bird in, and they could watch the bird, and if the bird started having symptoms, they knew there was not the air was not right for breeding.
Right.
And in Smithsonian Magazine, there was an article that in 1986, a mining tradition dating back to 1911 ended. 1986, they were still using canaries in the 80s when this song was written.
I'm wondering, though, it must have just been a tradition at that point.
They said new plans from the government declared that an electronic nose, a detector with a digital reading, would replace the birds in 1986. So, I don't know if they were the only place using them, but I thought that was kind of funny that they're still doing that.
If you're in the coal mine, though, I can see the attraction of having this bird there because it's not going to run out of batteries. It's not going to have some type of electronic failure. It either lives or dies.
I love that reggae kind of influence. You can hear that a lot.
That was big, obviously, with the Clash before that. And now with the Police, that was a very
influence. That's where they got their start, wasn't it?
Well, Copeland wanted to get into the punk scene and form a band. And so he's like, we can make money if we do this. And he hired this punk guitarist from France, Henry Padovani. And they wrote the song Fallout, if you know Fallout, by the Police. And so Sting was a little bit more like, we can't just, you know, be punk. We got to do some more interesting stuff. And so they got into some more. This song has a little bit of a jazz influence. Yeah. You can feel that. Right now we're listening to Driven to Tears.
This is, you hear Copeland's percussion over there.
On the hi-hat, just tapping away.
This is a song about the divide between the rich and the poor. And it's the first song that Sting wrote for the band. And he said he was driven to tears while he was watching a TV show in America about these children in West Africa, in Nigeria. And he just basically said, it just broke my heart seeing this. And so, you know, he's kind of making commenting on that.
Well, Sting was very big in philanthropic things. So, they did try to raise money. The Secret Policeman's Other Ball.
And they did come together after breaking up, to do things, to raise money, to try to raise awareness over different issues.
Do you think this contributed to Geldof's movement for the
Live Aid
in 1985?
Oh, yeah. There were several, was it Tears for Campeachy?
Yeah.
There were several albums that were coming out.
Rock has or music in general has a long tradition of that. I mean, you had the concert for Bangladesh back in 1971. There's a lot of that. So I think it probably did contribute, but it's in a stream of that kind of thing.
Okay. So you hear that guitar player that, again, that was Andy Summers.
Yeah.
So for a brief time, they had four people because they kept Henry and Andy. Sting was invited to play in this project called Strontium 90. The original drummer of that project couldn't make it. It was just a project. And so he brought Copeland. So Sting and Copeland were there, and the guitarist in that band was an older, more experienced guy named Andy Summers. He's about 10 years older than the other guys.
Andy Summers is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's 10 years older than
I didn't know that, yes.
Yeah, he was in his 30s. They were in their 20s.
Okay.
And so they brought him on, they performed a few concerts as a foursome, but Andy was just so much better than Henry. I mean, Henry actually went on to play in a band that was more well known at the time. It was called Wayne County and the Electric Chairs. So,
oh, Wayne County and the Electric Chairs.
So exactly. Where are they now? So he went on to do that.
Electrocuted.
And but in an interview I saw on VH1's Behind the Music, he really seemed okay with it. He was glad that they had such success, and I think he agreed that that was probably a good move in the end. But at that time, with Andy playing guitar and Sting writing lyrics, Sting was like, I could do something now. I can do more. And that's when the band started to fracture a little bit. Because suddenly Stuart Copeland's like, this doesn't feel like my band anymore.
Yeah.
This is When the World is Running Down, You Make the Best of What's Still Around.
I love
that title.
A
long title there.
That's a good title for today, too.
Another song that's played quite a bit, even though it probably wasn't a hit.
Well, Don't Stand So Close to Me was the monster hit off of this album, and I chose not to do that because you can hear that every other day.
That reflects Sting's days as a teacher because he has these preteens and teens as a teacher coming up to him, and they're just so good looking. It's like, you know, don't tempt me.
Yep. That was one that a lot of times, like when my kids were younger, they would say, what does this song mean? And a lot of songs you're like, it doesn't mean anything. But this one, it's like, okay, let me explain this one.
Yeah, that's right. Well, I like this one, and because you don't hear it as much, and it's kind of that when life gives you lemons, make lemonade, you know? This reached number 3 on the Billboard charts in 1981.
Oh, so it was the hit. Okay.
Sting said that this song had kind of a post-apocalyptic vision, and it shares a little bit in the song Bring On the Night, which was from the Regatta de Blanc album. You can even hear it sound similar, but the theme is the same, too. It's about what's going on. I think that if you watch any of the documentaries, these guys, they really did fight. I mean, they were like brothers. They would, like, get each other in a headlock. Yeah. They would punch each other. They would throw
stuff. Stuart Copeland did his own documentary on it. So on one of these earlier albums. I don't know if it's this one or Ghost in the Machine. But, yeah, as the changeover, he was taking actual film of it. It was not even video. It was film. And, you know, but that's when he was losing the group to Sting, because Sting was the star. He was starring in movies. He was in, you know, The Who's movie, Quadrophenia.
When you can play bass like this, I'd say take over.
Well, he just became the face of the band because he was writing the songs. And like I said, he could do some amazing stuff with Andy, you know, playing guitar. And they just did well. But they could not stay together. I mean, they would get together, perform a concert, and walk off in different directions.
Now, if you want to see Sting in a starring role or a great role, Dune, back in the early 80s. Yeah. He was a great role in that.
There were several in there where he did, where he had a minor or a major role. But he was, you know, he was the face, right?
Yes. A funny thing about, I read about their hair, the bleach blonde hair that became the band trademark happened by accident. In February 1978, the band was desperate for money. Wrigley's asked them to do a commercial that, on the condition that they dye their hair blonde. So they shot the commercial, but it never aired. But then they got out there with their blonde hair.
So they were sellouts.
Exactly. I like that.
Before selling out was cool.
That's right. From an advertising perspective, I thought that was pretty fun. But, man, I mean, the collection of the Police is so
good. Get all five albums. Get all.
Yeah, and it's Sting, too. We've covered Sting, and he's...
He mellowed out a lot.
Watch the documentaries. They're really cool. I think you'll like that.
That's amazing.
So now we're going into our entertainment pick.
When we first moved to New York, we had a great apartment that was dirt cheap.
And
we
found out why. This is Bosom Buddies. You guys remember this sitcom? I was in college. I'd started, so I didn't really watch it. But this is Tom Hanks in his first starring role with Peter Scolari. It aired only for 2 seasons. And, of course, obviously he had the stellar career as he always had. So.
Yeah, they were dressed up as women to live in an apartment, right, that was only for women.
Exactly. So it was kind of hard to pick up women when you were straight as dressed as a woman. Yeah, it was actually pretty fun.
So they
for well, Billy Joel's.
Yeah, I forgot that it used the Billy Joel theme, didn't it?
Yeah. So that was the theme music that they used, and it was a funny show. When I was younger, if you ever find any old pictures of me, people used to say that I reminded them of Tom Hanks, or Tom Hanks reminded them of me, or whatever.
I can see that.
So and I don't know if I look like an old Tom Hanks, but when I was younger, I did. But that was just one of those goofy sitcoms, you know. Remember Three's Company? It was kind of that kind of thing where guy has to live with the girl to have things happen. So,
also in 1980, in November, Barbara Mandrell and the Mandrell Sisters, their first premiered. They had their little, I guess, musical / skit special type thing that happened every week.
Yep.
They always ended it with a gospel song. I didn't know that. I remember them having it. And Too Close for Comfort was on ABC that started in November of 1980. Yeah, it was one with Ted Knight and his daughters and stuff. And that was a fun one.
And he always wore the college jerseys.
Yep.
All right. Well, that was our entertainment track from Right Column Financial. And we're back into staff picks now. And we're leading it off with Mr. Brian DeCute.
No, not me.
No. You're just getting into it.
I am. I'm raising my hand because this is one of my favorites.
Mr. Bruce Fricks. I thought
this
Brian was ready to start singing.
I
might have to.
That bass line.
You may find yourself.
That's amazing, isn't it? That voice. Oh, yeah.
The only thing I can see right now is the video of him hitting himself in the head.
Yeah.
Just boom.
You want to hear
boom.
Something embarrassing, though? Some people at work will go, when he goes, same as it ever was, you go up and down your arm, you know, same as it ever was. We'll do that at work, and the other people going, what are you guys doing? This is it.
So, this song is Once in a Lifetime by the Talking Heads. And it is really, at the time, there really wasn't anything like it out there. I mean, New Wave was kind of the fashion. You know, you had the Cars and things like that, but there was really nothing quite like this, you know? And it didn't do that well when it came out. It grew on in time based on that video, because MTV would hit in 1981.
Oh, man, MTV made so many bands.
They played the fool out of this one. So Once in a Lifetime was co-written by David Byrne and producer Brian Eno. It's the lead single off of their fourth studio album called Remained in Light. And it was not released as a single until February 1981, but it was already on the charts at this time. So that's the reason I went ahead and put it on for October 80. the music, there's two different influences. So the music itself is kind of an Afrobeat jam.
Yes.
And then the words... David Byrne had been watching a lot of evangelists, preachers and things, and so he picks out words and the way that they use the words for the song.
Yeah, it did sound kind of like talking about baptism, go down to the water, carry the water and all that.
Right.
Please tell me that he left a hanger in his coat. I mean, that's the reason why it looks that way on the video.
This was his thing. He would, for concerts, he would wear dresses. He would wear feathers. He wore, you know, it was.
Who do you think
anything.
He was? David Bowie?
Exactly. That was kind of his thing.
Peter Gabriel.
Well, he wanted to be the topic of the water cooler discussions the next morning.
One of the things I like is that little bass line. It continues. There's never a change in it. But when they go from the song, listen to this lyric. My God, what have I done? So I didn't say anything about the lyrics. The lyrics are, you know, it's a, you can't stop life. You know, the days are going by regardless of what happens. You know, and it's kind of this angsty type of a thing, but. It's amazing the way that they put this together. Then the what I was saying before, the between the verse and the chorus, there's a break. They do a little two section in the 4/4 to kind of change the beat.
It changes
so
up.
The accent of the beat changes just a little bit. Although the beat never changes.
Yeah. That's a good point.
The music video is by Byrne and Tony Basil.
Oh, hey, Mickey.
Of Mickey fame.
Mickey.
Yeah. And yeah, that's what made
You're
the song.
So fine,
is the
you
lyric,
blow my mind.
Is the video.
Same as it ever was. I mean, that's something that you could just say that line and everybody thinks about.
Well, that's what Brian was saying. Folks of our age, you
we
do certain things from the video and you know it. Or if you say same as it ever was, you know, or you may ask yourself, and everybody knows what you're talking about. So it's iconic, but I really
Or you walk out with a coat hanger inside your coat.
Great pick. Thank you, Bruce.
That's good. Mm. Good stuff. Well, we're continuing on to our next staff pick, and this one is called Stop This Game.
I was about to say, in the name of love.
Wayne's bringing it. What do you got for
Guys,
us, Wayne?
I bring to you Cheap Trick. Stop This Game. You guys obviously know Cheap Trick, Live at Budokan, and they had Dream Police. Those were iconic albums, and more than likely one of you guys will probably end up featuring it. But I know I've done, this is my second time doing a Cheap Trick song. First off was off the Heavy Metal album, if you remember. Well, this one right here, people, it was a hit. It did make the charts, but it did not make their, I guess, concerts.
They didn't play it.
Brian and I have seen them several times. We've seen them
together. So with Alice Cooper.
Yeah. So I'm with Alice Cooper. I've seen them with Alice Cooper and ZZ Top. So they're still out there. They're doing warm-up groups. They're doing it currently with Rod Stewart. And it's a great time. But this, you can kind of get the feeling. This is that music of them. Just you can feel this. But this is the first time somebody as a producer produced them. And his name was George Martin. Anybody? Not George R.R. Martin.
Yeah. I was about to say, if it's George R.R. Martin, no. We'd still be waiting for the song to come out.
Do you guys remember him?
From the Beatles.
He's considered the fifth Beatle. That's correct.
Ah.
And on this album, it's called All Shook Up. It was the album after Dream Police. And many consider this a little bit less friendly of an album that's, you know, for radio play and more experimental. But,
oh,
you know,
more prog rock. I was thinking at the time, it has a little prog rock feel to it.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't remember this song, but I could certainly picture it during this time. It's funny, he sounds a little bit like Lou Gramm, maybe, from Foreigner to me. Just a little bit there.
Yeah, I hear that. I hear that.
Well, they did have a great run. That late 70s, they were going great. 80s, is sort of hit and miss, and really, they kind of dropped off the face of the map by the mid '80s. You know, they had a couple of albums that came out sporadically, but you know, they're kind of regulated to warm up groups for, you know, better well known bands. But I mean, triply their catalog, they do have a good at least one full hour of great music going on, and I suggest going to see it. They are fun. If you know Rick Nelson is the guitar player, he always comes out with little funky different guitars.
Yeah.
And he has one guitar that has seven necks, meaning he's playing the guitar on different necks of the guitar. And it's pretty wild. You know,
does he call it the octopus?
It's only got five necks, so I guess not. It needs three more.
Didn't it have a plaid pattern or checkerboard pattern
exactly,
or something?
Exactly, yeah. That was sort of like a band's shoes. They were that sort of look.
Yeah.
But also, Rick Nelson, for your information, is on Cameo. So if you want to Cameo buy him.
Yeah, he did one for us.
Yeah, exactly. We just said, what the heck? But, you know, go out and look at them. They actually have a big interview with Dan Rather on Axis TV.
Oh, are all three of them on it?
Yeah, they're on there. There's more than three members. But, yeah, several of the members were interviewed for
cool.
that. And they talk about how, you know, they were doing it, and this song is, I've just lived before it, these is basically about a guy that met a girl, sparks flew great, but when they got to around, you know, 24/7, you know, I'm sorry, you know, it's just like the music, you know, you got to stop it,
stop this game.
Exactly.
Thanks, Wayne. That was good, because I hadn't heard it before, but enjoyed listening to
it. That was
we're gonna move on to our staff picks.
Now it is Brian's turn.
Yes.
Ooh. This song wasn't from November of 1980.
No, this was actually, the original was from Supertramp's blockbuster album,
Breakfast
in America. Breakfast in America is from 79. Mm-hmm. This is their live version of it from November of 1980 called Live in Paris. This is the logical song.
Oh, you can hear the audience clapping in the background.
Oh, yeah. I know we've discussed before about the favorite live albums. Of course, the things that we mentioned, Frampton Comes Alive. Other huge blockbuster albums. Mine, of course, is probably Live in Paris from Supertramp. This is just a lot of their songs that we all know, but it's just they do it very, very well. You can find the actual video on YouTube. You can see the entire
concert.
Yes.
Oh, that's neat.
I would highly recommend you watch it. It's really well done. Mm-hmm. And they're not really fancy showmen. They're just musicians. They don't sit around, dance around, and have these tremendous light shows. You're gonna see singers and performers.
Right.
But anyway, this song has always been an interesting song because I think it's more relative today than it is back when he wrote it in the 70s. It's about a kid who grew up with innocence, mm-hmm. and then goes to school, and everything changes. And you're talking about, what would you say they call it? Because he gets educated, institutionalized, or whatever, and he goes, and he comes out, they're calling him a liberal, a fanatical criminal, and he's disillusioned with what he's just been through.
Right.
So he goes and he gets out of school at the age of 19, and then he comes out and he goes, well, who am I?
Uh-oh, there's your sax.
Oh,
yeah.
Well, that's another reason why I like this song. But
so you're telling me that higher institutions of learning are spitting out
liberals,
radicals, and people like that?
Perish. Perish the thought.
Yeah.
Well, here's what he says when he was, from Song Facts, which I pulled, he says, I think it was very relevant when I wrote it, and actually I think it's even more relevant today. It's basically saying that what they teach us in schools is all very fine, but what about the things that they don't teach us in schools that create so much confusion in our being? You think about that. They're cramming you with all these things, and then you say, wait a minute.
Please tell me who I am.
And so if you listen to the lyrics, and it really is striking about what he is talking about, because that is, if anything, that's more relevant today. Kids get out of school and they go, what's it all about?
Right.
But, with him, we've talked about Roger Hodgson and Rick Davies, the one that you did, Rob, with the Crime of the Century.
Yeah, we did a
podcast.
A previous podcast with one of the albums.
Right, Crime of the Century. And, of course, they were a power duo. I mean, everything about this was Roger Hodgson. And it started to really, I think, the beginning of the division between he and Rick Davies and their coordinated efforts. But when Hodgson wrote this, he really didn't think the band would like it. So he presented it to them when they were talking about what they're going to put on the Breakfast in America, but they all loved it.
Yeah.
So it was probably one of his most accomplished moments.
I just missed the Mattel electronic football game.
Yes. You hear the Mattel electronic? they inserted that in there. So thanks for pointing that out.
That was great. Yeah, I'll have to
watch
that. They stay
very faithful to the original song.
Oh, yeah.
I'll look out for it on the...
check it out on YouTube.
Yeah, that sounds great. Listen to this keyboard, this synthesizer. It's just so cool.
We're coming back to Rob now on his staff pick.
This is Touch and Go by The Cars. It was written and sung by Rick Ocasek of The Cars. And this was their debut single from their 1980 album, Panorama. You remember that album?
Yes. Yes.
This was the most successful track on the album. It reached number 37.
But listen to that moody voice.
And the synthesizers, and then all of a sudden it picks up and it gets this energy. That's what I like about this.
Yes. This is where the volume just goes through the roof.
Doesn't this sound a little country to you?
I was just thinking it sounds a little like the Police to me.
I mean,
if you listen to the I don't know if it's the bass line, but the guitar rhythm.
Yes. Yeah, I agree.
Little reggae.
The Cars had a similar punk feel, like the Police did, actually, mm-hmm. during this time.
But they were called alternative at the time. You know, they were not a rock band.
Right. New wave. Maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. New wave.
But,
I could see that.
You know, Rick's voice made it softer and not quite as angry. Not quite as punkish,
Yeah.
And interesting thing I found that John Lennon mentioned Touch and Go in his final interview in December of this year, 1980. He said, I think the Cars' Touch and Go is right out of the 50s. A lot of it is 50s stuff, but with the 80s styling, and that's what I think Starting Over is. It's a 50s song made with an 80s approach. Hmm. So he kind of felt like the Cars were a 50s band that were, you know, playing in the 80s, was John Lennon
said. I can see that. I can.
Yeah.
Oh, this is, oh, man.
It's that the synthesizer is almost, when it's in the verses, it's like a chant.
Yeah. You know? Yes.
It's just this continual little bit of dissonance in there.
Oh, oh, oh.
Well, top hits of November 1980, Lady by Kenny Rogers.
Ooh, that was played a lot.
Who wrote
Your
that song?
Knight in Shining Armor, I Love You.
Lady? Anybody know who wrote Lady?
Wasn't that Lionel Richie?
It was indeed.
Woman in Love, Barbra Streisand.
And who wrote that song?
I don't care.
Barry Gibb.
I thought Van Halen played Women in Love.
They did. It's plural.
The Wanderer, Donna Summer. Another one, Bites the Dust, Queen.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, man. Yes. All the time.
I'm Coming Out, Diana Ross. Yeah. Sort of that disco dance
very
music.
Positive song. Yeah.
Never Knew Love Like This Before, Stephanie Mills.
Oh, yeah.
That was a really good song. Music of November 1980, The Ingles. Don Henley is arrested for cocaine, quaaludes, and marijuana that are found in his hotel room after a 16-year-old prostitute has drug-related seizures.
Oh, life in the fast lane surely make you lose
he
your mind.
He was charged with contributing to the delinquency of a minor. All he had to do is pay a $2,500 fine and put on 2 years probation.
Mm.
Oh, my goodness. All right, albums that came out. Neil Young had Hawks and Doves. ABBA, Super Trooper, one of the follow-ups of theirs. Motorhead, Ace of Spades. I'm surprised no one did that song.
Oh.
Lemmy.
We've got a few more slots in 1980. Yeah. We'll be able to pick it
John
up.
John Lennon and Yoko Ono had Double Fantasy. Yep. That would explode after he would get killed later in the year. Barry Manilow had Barry. REO Speedwagon, High Infidelity. We'll probably get to that album.
Got
to
do that.
Steely Dan, Gotcha, yes. The Jam, Blondie, Adam and the Ants, and John Anderson from Yes had All Out.
Did he have a solo album?
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that I'm trying to remember what it is. It's hard to think of another song when you've got one playing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this was the time. Just I think they were just Yes was just about to do. Was it Drama? I think there was their
right
album.
Right after Drama.
They did 90125 right after that.
About 3 years later. Yeah. Yeah, that was sort of when they were breaking up and everybody was kind of doing
it was
their
kind
own
of a
thing.
Low point for them, wasn't it?
Yeah. Drama was not a good album.
Well, Panorama is a pretty good album. If you want to just enjoy some Cars again, that's a good thing. That's a good one to pick up and have a listen to because it's got some good songs on there, but this was their most well-known.
Excellent pick.
So. Well, we're going into our instrumental track, and I took the liberty of picking one from Zenyatta Mandata because there was one on there, and this is Stuart Copeland. You can tell you can tell that he wrote it because it's got a lot of drum in there. So hopefully, this isn't cheating to pick up another song.
No, not at all.
Absolutely not.
I like that.
This is called "The Other Way of Stopping."
The
Other Way of Stopping. So there's a bit that Bob Newhart would do. Remember the comedian Bob Newhart?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, he's great.
And he did this whole radio bit about being a driving instructor and working with this lady that couldn't drive. And the other way of stopping is to put the car in reverse. So he plays the instructor, and you know he just talks like you don't hear her talk, but you hear him saying stuff to her. Well, I guess you could stop that way. There's always another way of stopping.
Now, those are classic comedy albums by Bob Newhart.
Yeah.
I mean, I hear people all the time from the 70s going, hey, I used to listen to Bob Newhart and Bill Cosby from the 60s and listen to those albums. Basically, you used to get an album. You used to know all the things. Cheech and Chong, I used to know all skits because of the albums.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, back in the day, you didn't have the video to go with it. You just had the album.
Yeah.
So I thought that was funny, though, that he got the name of this song from a Bob Newhart skit.
Yeah, yeah. But
anyway.
We also touched base on things we didn't get to in the rest of November 1980. And then in film, Steve McQueen dies in November 1970. And 1980.
He did his own stunts a lot
of
times,
exactly.
Didn't he?
The Great Escape is probably one of the favorites of a lot of people. The Magnificent Seven. To me, I always get into the Bullet. I mean, the car is iconic. Everybody, I mean, that thing, I think, went up for auction or going up for auction. A couple other movies that came out. Heaven's Gate, which was sort of a Western film. Cost $44 million to make and only made $3.5 million.
Whoops.
Yeah, exactly. But, I mean, Kris Kristofferson, Christopher Walken, Jeff Bridges, John Hurt, and Sam Waterstone's all in this movie. And it's like, you couldn't do that. But there was another one called The Visitor, which is a science fiction that had John Huston, Shelley Winters, and Glenn Ford in it. Sam Peckinpah. So, another one. But the big movie that came out was Raging Bull with Robert De Niro.
Oh, yeah.
Following Jake LaMotta, which is interesting, is this is when the first time Joe Pesci and Robert De Niro kind of meet up. And, you know, obviously they would do Goodfellas and several other movies together.
Yeah, they work well together.
Yeah. Well, that was November of 1980. You're listening to What the Riff. I'm Wayne.
I'm Rob.
I'm Brian.
And I'm Bruce.
We'll see y'all next time.
Thanks for listening to What the Riff? We hope you enjoyed the songs we had on tap today. Please tell your friends about us. Check us out at whattheriff.com and follow us on Facebook. Special thanks to our sponsors, Wright Collin Financial, Stanton Electric, and Marbury Creative Group. That's all for this week. See you next week on What the Riff?